Here's how we begin. Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet too at commonwealthclub.org. I'm David Eisenbud, Director of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute, also known as MSRI, formerly known in a joking way as Misery to the mathematical audience, and your moderator for the program. We've organized this program tonight in association with the Commonwealth Club. I'm going to next introduce our guest, Dr. Cedric Villani, a famous mathematician and author of the new book, Birth of a Theorem. Cedric was born in 1973 and attended one of the great French preparatory schools, Lycée Louis le Grand. He was educated at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris, where he was from 92 to 96. That was for many years the only source of all the great French mathematicians. More recently, the world has become more democratic and these things have spread out, but it's a place of great tradition and great importance in the world of mathematics. He got his PhD in 1998 under Pierre-Louis Lyon, working on mathematical physics and partial differential equations. He very soon became a professor at the École Normale in 2000, from where he moved to the University at Lyon, where he's now a professor. And he was director of the Institut Henri Poincaré, which is an organization similar to MSRI in Paris, from 2009 till now, I think, or almost now. Still a little while longer.
Still a few more years to come as a director.
Ah,
a good job, as you know, David.
Yeah. Directors of math institutes feel that they're the only ones who can really understand each other's problems. Cedric's primary work is in partial differential equations, statistical mechanics, mathematical physics. He's had a very broad swath of mathematics. He's won many prizes, but certainly the culmination from the mathematical world's point of view was the Fields Medal, which he won in 2010. That's for many, many years been the highest prize, although not the most lucrative, in mathematics. It shows that they are not the same for mathematicians.
Definitely not.
In 2012, in French, he published the book that has now been translated as The Birth of a Theorem. It became a real bestseller in France and has now been translated in several languages. Most recently English. I don't know how long this has been available, but it is now, and I enjoyed reading it very much recently. I think you will, too, if you get a copy later. In any case, please welcome Cedric Villani.
Thank you.
Now, I think the place to begin is at the beginning. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your early time and how you got enwrapped in mathematics.
Yes, and before that, let me notice that this is one of the most frequent questions that I get asked by all my hosts, and I think it's important because people nowadays all around the world are wondering so much about what makes young people go into the study of a specialized subject, such as mathematics, at a time in which around the world all countries are critically looking for these talents because they are becoming more and more rare. That's the feeling we have there, because it doesn't look like a 21st century career, you know. And on the contrary, it is very much. And so people are very much interested in how to make these young people motivated. I have to confess that there is nothing so spectacular about my youth. I was a shy, you would say a geek, you know. I was so much interested in reading all the time. I was considered so shy that even by the age of 17, when I completed high school and had performed so well that there was a local newspaper coming to interview me, you know, and the guy mentioned in his paper, Cédric, is a human monument to the glory of shyness. Looking back to it, now you know that I go on television every month or so, and I find it's nice. And I tell kids, don't be ashamed to be shy. There is nothing wrong with this. You can do great careers with this and so on. It will not be any harm. So that was me, very much often sick, you know, staying in bed, and there reading and reading and reading.
Ah. So that's the secret.
Maybe that's part of it. I was, and in those days, maybe the subject I was most fascinated with, nothing particularly original too, was dinosaurs.
Mm, yeah. What did your parents do?
Both my parents were high school teachers in literature, French literature. I studied Greek and Latin language. For the end of my high school, I had both the option of computer science and Latin language.
In many ways, both languages.
Yes, many people say this is so weird, you son of French literature teachers and doing mathematics. And I say, it's not so weird. What would be more weird is if I would have become a researcher while being, say, son of people... workers, for instance, workmen, or people doing working in the to cultivate or whatever, and somehow I was trained in an environment in which intellectual business was so much praised, and I could see my parents working regularly and so on. So going into work was natural for me. There it was mathematics. Okay, maybe could have been anything else. Not sure. When I reflect back, I think mathematics was like my subject.
What was the tipping point into mathematics? Do you have a sense of that?
You know, the French system is such made that if you don't make any choice and you're good in everything, you end up doing mathematics.
I see. That's the default.
You were mentioning it as all place, but that's true. So naturally, I ended up doing preparatory school in mathematics without having taken any decision. I was in Lycée Louis Le Grand, which boasts more than 300 years of tradition. And at that time, more than half of the class of mathematics in École Normale Supérieure was coming from this high school. Then I entered École Normale Supérieure, which dates back to the French Revolution, or kind of, and which is the place in the world with the highest number of alumni in who have been Fields Medalists, together with Princeton University. So, you know, always going in the tradition. That was me.
So Freud says somewhere that the child fulfills the unconscious desire of the parent. Do you think your parents had something for mathematics? Perhaps they moved out of the path for some reason.
Maybe there is something. So my mother made a point of working hard for mathematics. This I know when she was a high school student. And my father, I know, at some point did a special, you know, study for in high school on the normal law, on the Gauss distribution. So maybe they had some desire to do this. I have to say, when I was maybe 12 years old, they kind of were not able to help me any longer, so.
Now, you have been very interested in music, as we'll discuss later. Did you start with music in this early time?
Oh, I studied, yes, I took lessons in piano for years, and I took them back again when I was a student in École Normale Supérieure. So all in all, I did 10 to 12 years of serious piano lessons. And I was not so good, but not so bad. The last piece of music which I worked on seriously, for those who know, is Prokofiev's Sixth Sonata, the First War Sonata. I still consider it one of the great pieces of 20th century piano. And in those days, when I was, say, up to the age of 25, 26, I had to do my hour of piano, otherwise a daily hour of piano, otherwise I was just not feeling good. Then, you know, came the children, first professor job, the courses to prepare, etc. And yes, you have to make choices.
Yes, indeed. It's hard to keep up an instrument under those circumstances. I know myself.
We know it's common. People know that, we know in the community that music is the great love of mathematicians very often when it comes to the arts. And in terms of sport, it would be mountain probably, climbing for tragically sometimes. But
yes, indeed. Your taste in music is much broader than mine. And I wonder if that started early too. Did you like popular music back then as well as Prokofiev? Did you like Bach? That's the traditional love of mathematicians.
Yes. It really started later. I discovered classical music really seriously when I was in my early 20s, at the time when I was entering École Normale Supérieure. You know, after 2 years of studying hardly mathematics and focusing in preparatory school, I entered École Normale Supérieure, and there it was huge opening because all the fields were together. We were together with the people in physics, biology, but also people in literature, people in music, etc. And it was a big opening for me, and I could also enjoy and profit by the rich Parisian cultural life. So in those days, I would go to the movie theater almost every day, go to the concert almost every week. Soon I became in charge of the theater and music club, you know, buying the tickets for my fellow at reduced prices. The next year I became president of the students' union, you know, over in charge of everything. And there was a time where I would be listening for music for, I don't know, 8 to 10 hours a day in my room as an intern in École Normale Supérieure. And so there I started to listen to really a broad variety of musics.
Now, obviously by the time you were president of the student union, you had lost some of your shyness at least.
It seems
I realize you're still very shy, but we can forget this point. So are you aware of a time when that happened? Did you work to lose this? How did that come about?
Most of it came, I think, naturally, spontaneously. And I usually tell kids and parents when I have the opportunity, or parents, please don't bother, don't embarrass your child. If you have a shy child, this may come out just naturally. And I remember it. I don't remember being shy as something painful, but I remember something painful being told all the time, be bold, you have to speak up, and so on. This was painful. So this kind of disappeared naturally during my time in preparatory school, during my time in École Normale Supérieure. Just the fact of being in preparatory school together with many young people who share the love for hard work, you know, on the subject, makes a completely different perspective. All of a sudden, you're not any longer the geek who looks a bit strange to the other, to the other kids, but you are one in many, and it really makes a difference.
True, though some people retain that shyness even after that. Now, going on to the university side, how did you decide what field to work on in the university? One of the audience asked this in a different form, but let's start with the thesis and your choice of subject.
So the main keyword is trusting people and randomness. My strong field up to entering École Normale Supérieure was algebra. Clearly strong.
I'm an algebraist, in case you're curious.
I was clearly stronger in algebra than in analysis at those days. But then, you know, there was a mix of reasons so that I switched and turned to analysis. One of the reasons that was really bad is that somehow in École Normale Supérieure, I, took it a bit easy, not working so hard, and the algebra course was so much more demanding than the analysis course. Another reason was that I was tricked by a very, colleague, Henri Beresticky. Maybe you know him. This guy is so charming. When came the time of choosing the field, he would explain us partial differential equations as a field. You can do everything in there. You can do biology. You can go conquer the world. And the professors in algebra were, much more austere. Well, you do this and this and study this homomorphism and whatever. And somehow, I felt more going into analysis and PDEs. Later, I discovered part of the reasons were completely wrong, and I had been cheated on in this speech. I had been lured into the subject, but it's okay. And when came the time of choosing the subject, and my first thought was, among the many suggestions from the our advisor, for studies, was to go into image processing. And the plan was that I do a thesis in image processing with that professor and that other professor. But then somehow the word came that they did not get along so well any longer. I had to choose whatever. And anyway, my tutor, so was kind of personal advisor, Yann Brenier, whom you may know also. Sure. And he told me, look, don't bother image processing. Why don't you go and study Boltzmann equation with Pierre Williams? It's a great subject. I had no idea what this was. I had no idea who Lyons was. But I trusted Yann, and then let's go. And I remember the first day when Lyons wrote down the Boltzmann equation for me. I look at this ugly thing, and I feel, gosh. And he starts saying, you're going to start on this and that, and when you master the equation after a couple of years, we can turn to more tricky questions like this and that. And I thought, am I really going to spend 2 years with this thing? And yes, in the end, I fell in love with the equation in the course of the PhD. I started, it was like, what is this? And after some work on this, it was, gosh, it's such a beautiful equation. I wish I had been with it for all my life. And next thing I know, I spent 10 years of my life working on this equation. I was not so good in physics at school. It's such an irony that I ended up doing mathematical physics.
Maybe I should interrupt you and ask you to tell the audience a little bit the context of the Boltzmann equation, what it has to do with.
Yes. So Boltzmann equation is part of an important scientific revolution which arose around 1860 or so. And when we think of physical revolution in physics, the thing that comes to mind to most of people who are interested in the history of physics is around 1900 when people discover quantum physics, relativity, and so on. But more than three decades before, there had occurred this revolution which was in no way less important, and that was the statistical revolution. And the idea that you can understand a lot about the world around us by exploiting the fact that it's made of very tiny entities, very tiny molecules or whatever, a lot of them, and that we are macroscopic scale in this sense. We are macroscopic beings in a world which is made of microscopic constituents. And so it really makes a change in the physics. Even the physics at the level of the atom is not the same as the physics at our level, and statistics is what makes the bridge. And Boltzmann equation is a way to describe the evolution of a gas, like the air around us, predict how it will continue to evolve. Look, here, for instance, let's say that I'm waving my arms and so making some wind or whatever, disturbing the air around me. If I stop waving the arm, the air will very quickly go to rest. This is described by a Boltzmann equation, for instance. And it will make the bridge between the laws at the infinitely small scale and the laws at our scale.
Now, this brings me to something I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned children, and in your book you describe many interactions with your own children and sometimes with other groups of children. And in particular, you described giving a talk for kids, I don't know exactly what age they were anymore, about Brownian motion, which is one of the wonderful things of 20th century science and mathematics. So I got jealous at that point, and I thought, I would have liked to hear that talk, and now I have the opportunity. So let me ask you to tell us for a few minutes about Brownian motion, as if we were a crowd of children, which I think we are fundamentally, from your point of view.
Yes. From our discussion, David, I was sure you were going to ask something about beautiful Brownian motion. So let me give a short review of this. I will put in a few images, but I will also speak in such a way that we can do it only with words, these explanations. And as every good story in science, Brownian motion is at the same time a study of people, a story of people, a story of concepts, and a story of phenomena that we have to master, and so on. Ooh. And the story, even though it's true, Brownian motion is a thing of the 20th century. Brown himself was a guy from the 19th century, not a physicist, not a mathematician. Brown was a botanist. I put here a picture of Brown. I put here a picture of the microscope that he was using, which is preserved in London at the Linnaeus Society. And you can find online a short movie of what he saw one day when he was looking through his microscope. Something which is in agitation, particles which are randomly moving all around. Brown was looking at seeds, very tiny seeds put in water, and see how they would be going around in this crazy motion. And he was not the first one to have observed this. But people before him thought that this was a manifestation of the life in the seed. And Brown wanted to discuss this and wanted to say, okay, maybe this is not something living, so let's make experiments. His text is beautiful. Every child in natural sciences should read the text of Brown when he says, okay, let's make experiments and see it with a dead seed. And then let's make the experiment with powder of stone, you see, and he will observe the same exact pattern of random motion than the seeds. And he knew that it was a property of physics, maybe something deeply rooted in the mathematical laws. And explanation for Brownian motion only came after the statistical revolution I was alluding to, with Maxwell and Boltzmann around 1860 took over. And the idea that we could explain these properties maybe with the fact that nature is made of molecules. It was not a story that came easily, not that people said this and all the other people said, okay, now it's clear. Not at all. Not at all. In France, the chemist Berthelot, who was the most famous French chemist of his time, said as late as 1877 that the atomic system is nothing more than an ingenious and subtle novel. And he was not thinking of this as a good word, you know, just product of imagination. However, in the late 50s, Mark Katz, one of the greatest Polish-American probabilists of 20th century, would describe the book of Boltzmann as one of the greatest books in the history of sciences. What happened in between? In between what happened was the recognition of the truth of the atomic hypothesis. With a key date, 1905, with the solution of the equations that predict the evolution of the statistical evolution of these particles randomly moving. This was due independently to Einstein and Smoluchowski, and they showed that the same equations for statistic prediction of the position of these tiny particles were the ones that had been written almost 100 years before by Fourier in France to describe the propagation of heat. And you know, when heat propagates, it's a little bit as if there was these particles of warmth moving randomly. It's not the way it is, but it's in the mathematical world, it is as if. And there's another way you can describe it in mathematical world is as a random walk. Here is a random walk. It's often called the drunkard's walk. Imagine you are coming out of a bar late at night, having drank a lot of IPA or whatever, a good strong beer, you know, and you don't know where you're going. You cannot even make two steps in the same direction. Every step is random from the next one. What will occur? And mathematicians study this. It's like you are on a grid and each time going either left or right or up or down completely randomly. Mathematicians can predict that if you do this, you will end up at your home with probability one. You are sure to be back to your home if you do this. I don't advise you to try, because mathematicians also tell you that the mean time that you have to wait is infinite. But still, it's an interesting mathematical object to study. And when you do this random walk, it's like these particles going out in the water, and you can predict their properties, and there is a certain particular coefficient. So there are tricky equations, and a certain coefficient, usually called D, like diffusion, which tells you how easily the particle will wander and go around. In this diffusion coefficient, the physicists like Einstein worked. How does it depend? What does it depend on? Some physical constants. Temperature, because the more the agitation, the faster the particle moves. It depends on the usual constant pi, the Greek constant pi, because there's a geometric meaning behind it. It depends on the radius of the particles. It depends on the viscosity of the fluid, because if the fluid is very viscous, like honey, it will be so difficult to move in. And it depends on the famous Avogadro number, which is how many particles there are in a typical amount of gas, for instance. And in this quantity, everything was known except the Avogadro number. And physicists devised these fun experiments, these beautiful experiments, to compute the diffusion coefficient and from this to deduce the Avogadro number. Let's not go into the mathematics, but let's marvel over one of these experiments. Which was carried out by people like Svedberg and Perrin, Jean Perrin in France. You have a bunch of these particles in the water and this tiny region of this big container which is lit from time to time. Puff, puff, puff. And you count how many of the particles are in the small region that you lit, that you light, at regular intervals. I put here on the screen, for those who can see, these figures from the actual experiments. At some point, it was one particle only, on the other point, two. At the time, zero, 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 two, zero, zero, three, two, four, etc. And you get these many numbers, and in practice, it never went to more than five. However, working on the analysis and comparing this to the predictions, they were able to predict that the Avogadro number is 6. Times 10 to the 23, 1 6 followed by 23 zeros. This was a triumph of statistics, you see, that from a sequence of small numbers like this, you can predict such a huge number that nowadays our kids learn in school. And of course, physics teacher will give it as something which is given. This is the law, 6 times 10 to 23. Actually, it took decades of experiments, careful thinking, protests, mistakes, and so on, and so forth. This was one story of the Brownian motion. Let me also mention that it became later the key to financial mathematics. All the studies in finance nowadays based on mathematics are also based on Brownian motion. And let me also mention that in itself, it was studied as a beautiful mathematical object by a number of mathematicians, from Wiener to Levy to Ito to Mandelbrot to Odet Schramm to Kinshin to Kolmogorov to Fields Medalist Wendelin Werner. Let me tell for those people who do have a Macintosh. I hate to do advertisement and public, but here, or rather, who have a Unix system and who can go to the screensavers. There's a program called Wonder. This is beautiful, my friends. You can spend so much time looking at it. It's a representation of the Brownian motion. Working out the trajectory of the Brownian motion, and you see what a complicated, marvelous geometric object it is. It's like this tiny particle moving around, like the one that Brown once saw in his microscope. But it's also a beautiful geometric object in itself that you can study. It's a work of probability, geometry, analysis. It's at the same time very thick and very thin. It's kind of a fractal object. It's beautiful in its own respect, you know, in its own sake.
What a wonderful story that is. It has so many parts.
Thank you.
Yes, yes.
And well, so to come back to these kids, 10-year-old kids, yeah. I was entertaining in the hall of Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. I was showing them these images from Wonder and Brownian motion going on and explaining it's like a tiny particle, and you could see their eyes wide open. And I know from my son that they were talking about this still a week later.
Yes. Well, there's such a deep story there, and so typical of great mathematical developments, that starts in one place with heat. Who would know that that has to do with particles and movement, and then passes through these many filters of different minds and ideas and becomes so completely transformed into physics and chemistry and finance now. It's an astonishing story, but I think a very beautiful one. I wanted to pick up a thread which I lost in a way and go back to your more media things and your former shyness, terrible shyness that you evince so clearly now. And one of the audience members asked a question which I also wanted to ask, which I will paraphrase of what they said by asking, when did the spider crawl up you first and how did it come to roost there? Has everyone seen the spider that lives on Cedric?
Yes, here's my beloved spider. Actually, one of them. I have a collection of 30 plus now. But I, at some point, resolved that I did not want to tell the story and what and when I started to worry. Because, you know, people were coming up with all these poetic explanations. I thought, if I tell them the true explanation, they will be disappointed. It's better to let people make it. And I had so many stories and suggestions of how I came to where the spider. I prefer not to give the answer.
Even
after
the
all,
date. I was only asking the date.
Oh, started about 10 years ago.
Ah.
A bit more than that. Maybe 12 years ago.
Hendrik Lenstra, who was a professor at Berkeley for many years now, retired from there, told me once that when he was appointed full professor, he put on a suit, and as you probably know also, he has never taken it off, as far as I can tell.
I started about the suit. I started much earlier. I started wearing this when I was age 20 as a student in École Normale Supérieure, and I even made experiments with hats, with jabot, with a bunch of things, until I found this dress code and I thought, this is me.
One of the audience also asked whether the resemblance to Évariste Galois has any substance, any causal influence on you.
I don't think so, but you never know. You're always influenced of the culture you are in, and you never know why. So Galois, people often tell me, and the other guy people usually compare to me is Liszt. Actually, I was attending recently a concert by Boris Berezovsky. Some of you in the audience must know him. He's one of the most outstanding Russian pianists in this century. And he was playing, in Paris, these transcendental studies of Liszt. It was totally amazing, And after the show, I come to visit him in his room, and he sees me, he says, "Oh, you look like Franz Liszt. I have to take a picture of you with me."
All right, an alternative explanation. A little bit in line with appearance, of course, you've been extremely active and successful, I would say, in media appearances. You've been on many television shows. You've really done a lot in that direction. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your goals in that. What do you hope to accomplish in this way? It's so far from the usual academic course and the usual academic lecture halls.
Yes. Let me say first that it's important that I was in this my most important years of professorship were in Lyon. And in Lyon, we had this culture, in particular under the guidance of Étienne Gys, who is a very, very famous mathematician and very famous for his skills in showing mathematics. We were trained in the idea that it was important to communicate to the audience that it's a request from the general public, that also it's good for us, because, you know, when you talk to the public, you better understand what you're working for, and that it was kind of our duty also to promote the community and make sure that there is no segregation between society and the scientists. And so, from the beginning, I saw the difference. We were two French mathematicians to be honored with the Fields Medal in 2010. There was Ngo for his proof of the fundamental lemma, and there was me at the same time. Couple of days later arrived the first invitation for a big program on the TV, and I said yes, and he said no. And it was a clear result of the difference of culture between Lyon and Orsay. Uh-huh. And so I was there, very naive, you know. The guy, I was on the stage at the same time of a comic guy doing humor, famous for his low level humor, but I did not even inquire before going there. I just go on there. It could have been a disaster, but it worked out fine. And when it works, they give you another try and another try, and the more it works, the more they want you, and you get more trained. And I realized appetite of the public was just enormous. I go on very often. I mean, I do at least maybe at least once a month I go to TV and so on. But still, I decline most of the invitations. So numerous they are. The general audience, that's one thing I learned from this, is so thirsty of seeing us scientists talk and communicate and discuss and so on. We can never extinguish their thirst, in some sense.
That's a wonderful thing. I think this has not always been the case, but has somehow grown up in more recent years, over the last 20 years, perhaps.
I think things have changed in both, for the audience and for us. Because also, yes, 20 years ago,
true,
we would not have lost our precious time doing these kind of things, would have been considered a real loss of time. And now, on the contrary, you see how our minds of scientists have changed.
There was an evolution like that at MSRI, too, which started out as a kind of reclusive, quiet place. And then Bill Thurston, who was the director of MSRI before me, really opened it up greatly. The first big event was the Fermat Fest at the time when Wiles proved Fermat's theorem. And he audaciously rented the Palace of Fine Arts, a 1,000-seat theater, and people said he was completely crazy, but in fact they were scalping tickets outside the auditorium. And the wave has really come very strongly, and he continued it, and I have continued it too. I think it's very important what you do.
And I can tell also as director of institute at the same time that now it's my sixth year in the institute, and I could successfully get public funding for the institute, mm-hmm. for the extension, get a fair amount of millions to renovate and extend the institute so that we can soon we will be able to almost double the space which will be available for researchers, getting in a new building by which was built with Jean Perrin and so on. There is no way I could have got this funding without the media awareness, because also the politicians are sensitive to this. And it's, in some way, it's legitimate. If they see that there is good audience, that the citizens care for this, then they will be more prone to give money for this also.
They see you serving the public good.
Absolutely.
Very, very simply. And how do you see the output of this? How do you see the goal? Do people become simply more sympathetic? Do their children go into mathematics? How, if you were pressed to the wall to measure such a thing, and I know that this is more or less impossible, how would you go about it?
Yes. There are things which you could measure in principle. These are indeed the number of young people willing to go into mathematics. I receive almost every day emails from strangers telling me, wow, I saw your talk, I want to do this, or my son is dying for doing research, and so on. So I know there is some. How much is so tricky to evaluate, and all the more that it's long term, you know. Measurements should have to be made on a 10-year period or something like this. So, and that's the easiest part to quantify. The other, much more difficult to quantify part would be the number of people who are not scientists but become sympathetic to mathematics after seeing a TED talk or seeing a TV show or reading a text in the newspaper about this. This also I see has quite some impact, but very difficult to measure. However, there were signs. For instance, last year I was approached to become the and I became the head of the support committee for the mayor, now current mayor of Paris. So she. I was her support, and I did the campaign with her and so on. So the fact that in one of the most important elections in France, you get approached by a politician who wants you to endorse her was a sign of the major rise which we did in popularity.
Indeed. Indeed. That's quite something. Well, MSRI just hosted the first National Mathematics Festival in Washington, D.C. Some of you are probably aware. A few of you were there. And we had a tremendous turnout, which I think also verifies this point of hunger and interest in this.
You know, there's one thing. Research, people are realizing, is one of the spaces of adventure now available in our society. You know, in the old days, adventure was about discovering new continent. Now it's all so much paved, and you can get around the world in a couple of days, and there's travel agencies sending you to the Pygmies or whatever. So it's not so much rewarded. After, adventure was about making fortune. But now there are so many talk about inequalities, about all these problems and so on. And now there is this idea that you can do this big research thing. Even the stories which fascinate people about people becoming very rich or successful entrepreneurs are those which are mixed with science and technology, say Elon Musk or whatever. And they are fascinated about the way of using the innovation and the technology in something that will make mankind progress. And research in general is seen in this very positive way. Mm-hmm.
You made an interesting choice in your book, which I, as I say, enjoyed reading recently, about how to pursue this path and how to interest people, I presume was the idea, because the book consists perhaps half of emails between you and your collaborator, which are completely incomprehensible to me, for example, as a mathematician, and presumably to the lay audience as well, but certainly express something and give one some flavor. I'm very interested in your intention in doing that and how you yes. thought about it as you yes. put this together.
This was indeed... So let's talk a little bit about the book. So first, how did the idea of the book come out? Was not just my idea. It turns out that I was some point in a dinner in Paris, big dinner with hundreds of guests in the honor of Takeshi Kitano, the Japanese filmmaker, some of you know, who I discovered on this occasion, by the way, is a great math lover. Ah. And so there was this dinner, and at the table next to mine was the director of the Grasset Editions publishing company, famous for very, literature, high level and so on. And he approached me because first reaction was, obviously he was being bored in this dinner. And he see this guy, who is this guy with a spider on his jacket? I have to inquire. And so he investigated, found out I was a mathematician, already interested in communication, came to me and tried and invited me to come and visit his office, whatever. And then in those days, I already had projects of writing books for broad audience. But books like Brown and Motion, like What is the Entropy, something like this, you know. Uh-huh. And this he did not want to hear about. I want a book that tells me what you do as a researcher. What is your life like and so on. And I don't care about the science. And I thought, gosh, how am I going to do it? And then I thought, if I believe in what I just said, that science is an adventure, then let's tell it as an adventure novel. And there's a big goal to conquer, and there are setbacks, and there are mysteries, and there are accidents, and there is luck, and somebody saves you, and so on. And I found out it all was there in the story of my adventure together with my former student, Clément Mouhot, trying to uncover this mystery of the Landau damping, which was a phenomenon in statistical physics about plasma. But I told the story not explaining what the scientific problem was or how it was related, but only about circumstances and exchanges, and I wanted it to be a testimony of how it is like. You know, I often say that a comparison, there are two ways if you want to explain your young kid what you are doing, and you are doing this technical job, whatever. First way is to talk to your kid and explaining in simplified words using analogies that he or she can understand. You know, simple word, and then you cheat, but you make it accessible. And the other way is take your kid at office, put the kid in a chair, and then the kid can observe you work all day. Doesn't understand what you're talking about, doesn't understand what you're doing, but he can hear the discussions. He can see if there is tension in the air, or if there is suspense, or if it's boring, or if you're fed up, etc. And that is this second approach, which is in the book, as if I am taking you and the reader to my office, watch upon my shoulder. Here's what Villani is writing. Here's what he's thinking. Here's why he's terrified. Here's what he's happy. He's working late at night, discussing with the colleagues, having lunch, sending email, all this. And I wanted it to be perfectly faithful. The formulas are there, and you can see, you know, I'm talking about little particle wandering, that's fine. But in the end, we have to prove a damn theorem with monster equation, and it has to be all logic. And here's the feeling of what it is, what it looks like. And also the mistakes. When you tell the story long after, you say, okay, that's the way it is, and it's so simple, and let me explain you in a few minutes. In reality, it takes you years of mistake and setbacks and convoluted way and so on. And I wanted this to be there, totally honest, not distorting anything, and very faithful to how we work. The language we use, the things we write, even is the first book for broad audience that I know which has been entirely typeset in tech, the typesetting program which we use for mathematical formulas. And so, and such, it's a reflection of what it is like. So, an anecdote about the book can be understood as a pregnancy, you know. Birth of the theorem, the birth really is the final chapter of the book, when the theorem is published. That's when you get out of the womb and are out there for living your life. But the first chapter is like fecundation. There is discussion between two people, that's me and Clément, and interaction, and at the end of the interaction, we decide to work on this, which was not our first intention. So something has occurred, which is like a seed has been produced, and then you need to work so that it can have some germ. My first French title was Naissance d'un théorème, yes. But by the way, the French editor said, don't you have something more ambiguous, more romantic? So I came up with living theorem, théorème vivant. It is ambiguous, you know, what is living? Why a theorem should be living? Is it the guy who's the living theorem? What the hell? And it rang a bell to me as a child when I was, you know, sick child in bed and so on. One of the books that was fascinating me were Desert Leaves, a book by Disney with photographs. Maybe some of you saw it in the old days. Desert Leaves, and in this Desert Vivant book, there were pictures of life in the desert. To somebody who doesn't know it, desert is this dry, boring, dead place. But if you know where and when to look, it's full of life. Colors are these flowers, these animals, this life, this fight, and so on. Mathematics is just the same. For people out there, this dry, boring subject, they took telling them about the Pythagoras theorem and whatever thing that nobody cares about. That's what they think. But if you know where to look, it's full of life and passion. That's exactly it. So I liked it, the theorem vivant, and they liked it. But then came the English translation. And the English, the American editor said, you know, living theorem, it's so ambiguous. Why don't we call it birth of a theorem? And I said, okay, let's do it.
I do think the tastes in French literature and poetry certainly tend much further towards the ambiguous and the obscure than English.
Absolutely, that's what we are taught in high school. Never be too explicit in the literature and poetry.
Always a question rather than an answer. Yes. The movie that you feature in is like that too. I wondered as I read the book whether you kept a diary during that time, aside from the emails, because you seem to have complete recall, or you're reconstructing plausible things. I couldn't tell which.
Yes. For the end of the book, it was diary, because the decision to write the book came at a time where the tale of the book is not finished. So. Near the end, it is diary, but all the beginning was reconstructed from memories and emails. There is so much in emails. In particular, when I in Princeton, you know, for several months working at the Institute for Advanced Studies, and from time to time I send these long emails of news to some friends in France. And in those emails, I found much information again. Mm-hmm. And so this was reconstruction, most of it, and a little bit was had to make up with plausible things, but say 99% is I'm sure of.
Gosh, there are lots of interesting questions from the audience, but there are a few topics I really want to touch. One is one of your many other activities and interests, which is music and its relation to autism. And I wondered how you came into that study and what perhaps you could tell a little bit about what you've done there.
Yes. This is another thing that I learned when you are a scientist. So we scientists are very popular. We don't realize this. And if you become a renowned scientist and so on, projects just arrive to you, and you all you have to do is sort between them and choose which ones you want to work on. And this project just arrived to me, okay, I'm exaggerating slightly, but In the book, you notice there was, I talk a lot about this French singer that I admire a lot, Catherine Ribeiro, and how her music was a lot of help to me when I was working hard on this Landau damping problem. And so I became friend with her. She's still alive, even though not active as a singer. And she put me in contact with a former musician that she used to work with and that had this amazing project involving music and autism. And he was in search of help. And I went into this and became soon the president of his association. And there we were together, you know, going to get funding and explaining the project and so on. And so this guy, Patrice Moulet, who, by the way, is the younger brother of a famous New Wave film director of the 60s, Luc Moulet. And so Patrice has been doing these new innovative instruments for decades, instruments which are very physical, sensual, instruments in which you have to stretch or to bump on the instruments and so on. And some of them he found, it was just for research in terms of music. But then he discovered it was extremely powerful in communication with disabled youngsters, in particular autistic children and youngsters. And you see them on the recorded sessions, these kids just opening up in front of the instrument, bumping on it, because it gives you such a power, such a feeling of empowerment, or the music coming from it. You don't need technical skills like piano to practice them. You are naturally led to open, to stretch, to unfold yourself. You can play several at a time. You can have 3-4 people playing on this and so on.
Could you describe one of the instruments for a moment?
Yes.
It's hard to get a picture.
A big multicolored mushroom with many of these various plaques. These very weird instrument. For those who can see, I will put on the screen one of these examples.
Can we have the screen connected again?
Yes, or? I will put
there.
Here. I have to plug this.
This would help.
And yes, this will help. And it's one of these projects. This is, I came into this. It's really fascinating, and I'm so grateful to be involved in these kind of projects. So, you see this? This is Patrice with what will become one of these music instruments. All these colors, this variety of colors, which is in there. Yes, here. Let's put a bit. Yes, this is one thing. This is how the instrument looks like from behind. It's all monitored through tech and computers. There is an interface because you have to damp a little bit the sound if there are too many of the sounds put together, because it should not be cacophonic. This is one of these instruments in the construction. This is the final result. And you see this kind of mushroom, yes. There's something magical in the shape. You see it, first, people who see it naturally try to bump on it. It's like automatic. And some people can stand on it, some people can caress it. It's sensitive to the amount and so on. And we had a project like, oh, this is one of these other instruments. On this instrument, which is like a triangle with tiles, you dance on it, and it plays the music as you are dancing, and you can make. So we organized concerts with this, in which professional artists were side by side with disabled youngsters. In some cases, unfortunately, strongly disabled youngsters. It was an element of bet working on this, and it worked just fine.
Are you still involved with this work?
I am more involved than ever. We managed to get some very good a building in which we can move in to make the experiments. We meet some big partnerships, and then we have to find goddamn money, of course. That's always the thing. There is this French song which I like to quote by Dutronc. Maybe some of you know this guy. And he has this song, L'amour est le moteur du monde. Love is the motor of the world, and money is its fuel. And it's so true. All the projects you make, it's always passion which drives them. But you need money to fuel them. You need the combination of both. And so we're working on this. Hopefully, we have a 2-year plan at which we'll have both sustained financing plus some new, plus the building, plus the new project, and so on. But this also I learned, be it as a director of institute or president of association or as a researcher, to do something, you need time. It's not, you need years and years until you can make your project really grow.
Yes. Well, that's certainly a very important kind of work. Oh, we're nearing the end of our time, and there's so many things we could talk about. One that I wanted to be sure to touch on, so maybe I better jump to it immediately, is a project you told me about today, which I didn't know about at all before, a project to write a graphic novel, your next work.
Yes.
So there are many next mathematical works, and I wish we could talk about that too, but let's start with the graphic novel.
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit about
yes.
it?
So it started as a wish of mine to pay a good tribute, a graphic tribute to Alan Turing for the centennial of his birth. This was 2012. I am a big fan of comics, you know, all kinds of comics from America, from Asia, from Europe. And somehow I was so embarrassed that there was no graphic novel about Turing that I thought was really paying good tribute to it. And I was discussing this with a friend of mine, also in comics, and I said, it would be so great if, for instance, and I gave the name of a French artist whom I love, who does comics, his name is Baudouin. Oh, imagine if Baudouin was working on this. And this was such an accident. My friend was also a friend of Baudouin, and he told me, so I'm going to make you meet the guy, and then it's your job. And there I was, working on making a graphic novel to pay tribute to Turing, but by then the project enriched. And now the project, which was just out in France a few weeks ago, under the name Les Rêveurs Lunaires, like Moon Dreamers, something like this, is a project which is about creation, a bit like Birth of a Theorem, you know, what's behind creation. And in the sense that, this Birth of a Theorem, yes, in the sense that we will represent very interior way several people who played a crucial role in society, and in this case, all of them in Second World War, behind the scenes, and represent them as they are thinking and working and wondering and also reflecting about their role in the past and the future. These four dreamers are Heisenberg, Turing, Szilard, and Dowding, played various roles. One of them was on the German side, the other on the Allied side. Three were scientists, one was a military, one was a mathematician, and two were physicists, and so on. And there are common themes going through this, but also differences. And it's a way to do history of sciences in a certain way, but at the same time very human side of it. And I was totally thrilled in the end. So we worked like 2 years on this, almost daily basis, lots of email exchanges. And I'm so proud of the beautiful drawings he made, Baudouin. I have followed his work for 12 years or so, and I think this is one of his most beautiful books.
Now, I was supposed to have reminded everyone a long time ago that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program and that we are talking to Cedric Villani. It's almost too late, but still we're talking. And that I'm David Eisenberg, director of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute. It's 2 minutes to the end, and we have time for one last question. And I suppose I think one I have to ask the question that came from the audience. Is mathematics a science or an art? Do we discover, do we invent? What are we doing here?
Okay. First, to me, mathematics is indeed a science, even though many people like to differentiate science and technology and mathematics. There is even this acronym STEM for that, science, technology, mathematics.
But STEAM now, maybe the A includes... Which
maybe
is art.
STEAM, yes.
Yes, should include yes. Mathematics.
I like to
too.
Think of mathematics as a part of science, but it's also for sure an art. Yes. And it's also, I want to remind it, it's also a social activity. I mean,
yes.
Community, doing math. And for me, I mean, through mathematics, I traveled, I have written, I have done so many things. But I think of myself always as a mathematician in the first place, and it's part of all these social activities related to mathematics. And sciences are all also. It's not just that we are doing things in a very dry way, just for purpose. It's also a part of our humanity. It's also a social activity.
I think the intent of the question was also. The old question of whether we invent mathematical things, it's, if they are things,
yes.
or
yes.
whether we discover them.
I belong to the idealistic group of people who believe we discover truth, which existed long before man appeared. In the old days, they looked like naive, but I think now they are majority.
I think... All mathematicians feel that way, though it's hard to defend. Anyway, this is perhaps a good time to end. Our thanks indeed to Cedric for a
Thank
very
you so
interesting
much.
Discussion. I remind you that
Thank you.
Cedric has a new book here, Birth of a Theorem, and I want... to thank the audience here and on radio, television, internet, and remind you that tonight's program was organized by the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute in association with the Commonwealth Club. Dr. Villani's book will be on sale in the lobby, and he will be signing books there. And he has one last thing to say, apparently.
My last thing, let me say it's great pleasure for me to be making these events in Bay Area, which was a place very important in my mathematical development also. Of course, I am a French mathematician, product of Lyon and Paris and so on. But the time I spent as a Miller professor in Berkeley University and the time I spent in MSRI, all in all, adds up to almost 1 year of my life, which was extremely important period in my mathematical life. So I'm so glad, also I'm proud to be here presenting the book.
This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.